In last week's episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, we featured the school, Gresham School, in Holt in North Norfolk in the UK. We talked about a cricket match that was held in the middle of July, just a few weeks before the outbreak of the First World War, where the school cricket team took on the Old Boys. And out of the 24 players that appeared in the match, if you recall, 11 of them didn't return home. We talked about a few of them last week. But one of them, I realised this week, I would be close to where he fell on the Passchendaele battlefield in September of 1917. So I thought what I would do to follow his story whilst I was on the battlefield. So I took my microphone with me, and what I tried to do for this episode is tell his story and try and discover what happened to him in the place where it really did happen. We look at the official battalion records of the 2nd 5th Lincolnshire Regiment. And we've also got a letter that was sent home to his parents by his older brother that was with him on the day that he fell. There's now a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery in that location, and that's where most of this episode this week was recorded. There's also, after we hear about Captain Neil Newsome, one or two other interesting stories. And whilst I was on the battlefields over 3 days, I recorded several hours of podcast material, which will be included in the podcast in the next few weeks. I went with an idea of what I was going to record when I was there, but as I cycled round on my e-bike, I found lots more stories that I wasn't expecting to find. And if you recall, again, a few weeks ago, we had the England World Cup winner Lewis Moody on the podcast when we visited Twickenham. We were looking at the stories of two rugby internationals that fell at Gullimont on the Somme in 1916. Well, this week, Lewis was over on the Passchendaele battlefields, and he went to see one of his ancestors' name on the Tynecott Memorial. Lewis was with his mum and some friends, and I joined them and gave them a tour of Tynecott Cemetery, and they also participated in the last post ceremony at the Menin Gate. And talking to the Menin Gate, I interviewed one of the volunteers there, Yuri. Next year will be the 100th anniversary of the opening of the Menin Gate. And I had a discussion with Yuri about what the plans are both for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission and the Last Post Association. And that episode is coming up next week in Tales from the Battlefields. So let's travel over now to the Ypres battlefield, to Doshi Farm Cemetery, a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery that is located about 7 kilometres northeast of Ypres itself. The cemetery was made after the armistice when isolated graves were brought in for the nearby battlefields. But some of them, quite a way away, some of the burials here, the men had fallen at Bosingay and St Julian, as well as on the nearby battlefield, Passchendaele. It's almost in the shadow of the village of Passchendaele. There's now 1,439 burials and commemorations. Well over half of them are unidentified, with 958 of them missing men. 295 of them are from the UK, of those that have been identified. 97 Australians, 46 New Zealanders, 35 Canadians and 8 South Africans. But of the unidentified casualties, 229 of them came from the United Kingdom. And as we make our way through this podcast, we're going to see whether we can prove or disprove that the man we're following, who died around Doshi Farm, is one of those unidentified casualties. And we'll go through a process of trying to prove or disprove that. So I'm at Doshi Farm, Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery, high up on towards the Bellevue Spur. And one of the graves I've come here to see, I've seen many times. We've featured him on the podcast. Jimmy Spears, famous footballer
from Glasgow Rangers, scored the winning goal in the 1911 FA Cup final. And I recorded an entire podcast about him here, I think it was last summer. And today is the 23rd of August, just a couple of days after the 109th anniversary of Jimmy's death, close to Doshi Farm. And it's obvious that he had some visitors on that day, because there are Glasgow Rangers and other football scarves wrapped around his headstone, and lots of a wreath and lots of photographs of him in his football kit, and a picture of him in his Bradford City kit, which is the other scarf on his headstone. It was for them he scored the winning goal in the 1911 Cup final. But the man I've come to talk about here doesn't have a grave. Well, as far as we know, he doesn't have a grave. A couple of weeks ago, if you recall, I told the story of the cricketers, the cricket match held at Gresham School in Norfolk, in Holt in Norfolk. 11 of the 24 players that played that day were to die during the Great War. And one of them was a man wearing spectacles, Captain Clement Neil Newsom, known to his family and friends as Neil. He was serving as an officer with the 2nd 5th Battalion of the Lincolnshire Regiment when they attacked here on the 26th of September 1917. Newsom was killed in action. He has no known grave, and he's remembered just on the far side of the valley, goes up onto the next ridge, where Tynecott is. He's remembered on the memorial there. We're going to go and see his name on the memorial later. But we may possibly find a grave for him, either up at Tynecott or here in Doshi Farm Cemetery. He's not in the photograph that was taken of the cricket team. He was 12th man, did play a part in the game. And to find out who he was, well, he attended the school for 5 years between 1909 and 1914, and he was one of many promising boys from the headmaster Howson's own house. He won prizes for history and English. He was a keen sports player, and he attended meetings of the debating society as well. The headmaster Howson made him captain of his house and later the whole school captain. And during the Christmas holidays of 1914, like so many others, he decided to leave school in order to join the army, and he was commissioned into the Lincolnshire Regiment in February of 1915. And at the age of 21, he was promoted to captain, and not far away is Polygon Wood, and he was involved in a successful attack there earlier in the summer. Now, on that day, Doshi Farm itself, the location of that is still there. I can see a modern farm building just on the other side of the main road that runs here between Zonnebeek and Langemark. Very busy road, as I say. There's a new modern farm building. It wasn't there a few years ago, but it is there now. That's on the exact site of many of the farm buildings that were converted by the Germans into strong points with pillboxes and interconnecting trenches. Now, by this time in September, although it had rained and rained and rained, as we know, since the start of the battle on the 31st of July 1917, for 2 weeks before this attack, there'd been dry weather and the ground here was fairly firm. And the artillery bombardment that hit the German strong points here was absolutely terrific, and they found that the Germans put up a very little fight because of this enormous artillery bombardment. This mass of craters that was here almost lip to lip. There was a mist lying over the salient, and this put the Germans into a disadvantage. Now, the battalion itself had suffered casualties earlier in the battle for Passchendaele, and they were only at half strength, really, with not quite 600 men and officers that went into attack that day. By the middle of 1917, the war was destroying the resilience of men on both sides. This was now a conflict of attrition, which could neither be fought with confidence and optimism, nor abandoned for the sake of the thousands who'd already lost their lives. The battalion diary gives us a copy of the orders, It says at 0 hour plus 100 minutes, the 2nd 4th and the 2nd 5th Lincolns on the left will pass through the battalions in front, and following the barrage will gain the blue line. Under cover of the final protective barrage, they will reorganise and consolidate, occupying any captured strong points. One of those strong points was Iberium and Tulip Cottages, but also Doshi Farm, where I am now.
So to find out exactly what happened compared to the orders, Battalion Diary was completed in pencil after the attack. It tells us exactly what did happen. The battalion moved up at 11 p.m. from reserve positions by moving by tracks in single file. Now, what it means by that is these are duck boards, wooden duck boards that have been laid down by the Royal Engineers, the only way of moving up and back through the battlefield at this stage. Men knew that if they slipped off these wooden duck boards, they were in danger of drowning in the mud. And because they went up in single file, it took a long time for them to reach their jumping off positions or their assembly trenches. But it says they reached the position of assembly and the line extending for 400 yards. The forming up was carried out on tapes previously laid out, the limits of each platoon being marked out by pegs bearing the number of the platoon. The heavy bombardment of the enemy's position was short. And in terms of short, what they mean is they don't mean it's falling short. They mean it's a short period of time. It was from 2 hours before 0 hour right up to 0 hour. And 0 hour was at 5:50 a.m. The troops moved in the formation to which they'd formed up and followed the 2nd 5th Leicester Regiment, who were in front. The 2nd 4th Lincolns were on our right and the Sherwood Foresters on our left. The battalion attacked on a two-company frontage. C Company Captain C.N. Newsom, our man, was in support. Only 20 officers took part in the attack, the remainder remaining in the transport lines. The formation was maintained until the objectives were reached. D Company on the left met with practically no resistance, the concrete blockhouses being non-existent. D Company commenced to dig strong point and sent a platoon across to assist B Company with the capture of Doshi Farm. B Company attacking Doshi Farm as the final objective were met by the enemy's machine gun and rifle fire, but worked to the flanks of the blockhouses when the Germans surrendered. Some 50 prisoners were captured here. The final consolidation, a Lewis gun post, was pushed forward in front of each company's position. Disposition at 8:30 a.m. Strong points under construction at Doshi Farm, shell holes connected with each other and consolidated a line of shell holes. The enemy's barrage was fairly heavy, but the attack had pressed well on by the time it fell on our old front lines and the places of assembly, and did not cause many casualties. It was then directed against the newly taken positions, where casualties were rather more. In particular, the captured concrete boxes came in for more than usual attention and seemed to be places to avoid. The consolidation proceeded during the morning and afternoon. Late in the afternoon, the enemy increased very much in intensity, and a small number of enemy were seen moving in front of our positions. A few men, of what regiments to us are not known, commenced to retire, as did the left brigade of the 3rd Division on our right. And a general retirement appeared imminent. Our own barrage fell in front of our positions, and the retiring troops were rallied and resumed their positions. The frontline posts did not withdraw. The cause of this withdrawal has not been discovered, but there was no heavy counterattack, nor did any of the enemy attempt to pass through our barrage on this front. By 8:30 p.m, all original positions were occupied. The men behaved with the greatest gallantry throughout, and on several occasions had to be checked from passing through our own barrage to the objectives, especially during the wait behind the 2nd 5th Leicesters. Until 0 hour plus 100 minutes, when the battalion passed through the 5th Leicesters to our own objectives. It was found quite possible to keep up with the barrage, which in the later stages moved 100 yards in 8 minutes. Company commanders maintained the direction of the attack by means of compass. The enemy did not show much fight, and sections of A Company attached to B and D companies acted as mopping up and did not have much to do. Communication was efficient, both forward and to the rear. Situation reports were sent back to division by pigeon and reached their destinations safely. Communication with brigade was chiefly carried out through relays of runners as the telephones continually broke down. The operation was a complete success. It's not a phrase that we normally associate with actions on the Passchendaele battlefield. And one of the reasons why it was successful was because all of the officers taking part in the attack, including Newsom, carried out a full recce of the ground in which the attack was to be made. They couldn't quite see the objectives because of the mist, and this was known as Hill 37, which of course was not in British hands. But they were fully briefed, they knew exactly what they got to do, they were well trained and determined, and achieved their objectives they did. Not only that, they held their objectives, because the Germans were so demoralised they didn't, as they normally do, carry out any immediate counter-attacks. Tells us that the night after the attack passed quietly and no attempt was made by the enemy to recover the captured ground. That's again in the battalion diary. But then it goes on to tell us what the cost of the success was. It says that the following casualties were incurred during the action of yesterday and the subsequent shelling. So this tells us that most of these casualties that we're going to mention now weren't caused in the initial attack, but they were caused by the German shelling of the strong points that occurred afterwards. Officers killed. Second Lieutenant Lowe, missing. Captain G. Hill, Captain C. N. Newsom, our man, and Second Lieutenant P. Grantham. And after each of them, it says in brackets K. That means killed. So they're reported missing, but someone had reported, whoever wrote the battalion up, diary up, that they'd seen those three officers killed. And then there's another one, two, three, seven more officers that are wounded. But other ranks, estimates total casualties, 350, over half of the battalion's strength. Although they'd been successful, over half of them had become casualties. And as we know, Neil was one of those casualties missing. But we do know more detail about what happened to Neil on that day, on that fateful day. And that's from a newspaper article back home in Lincoln that contains a letter that was sent back to his parents by his brother, the eldest son, Henry Newsom. He said that Neil was chosen to lead his company in a difficult and dangerous task, that his men declared that he set off cigarette in mouth and, in their own words, as cool as a cucumber, the first over the top, and from the first not only commanding but literally leading his eager comrades. The attack was successful and all the objectives were gained, but the company returned without him. Rank and file, who followed and loved him, told how, after they'd won the position and were consolidating it, they saw their gallant captain struck by shrapnel and killed. The article goes on to tell us that Neil came home from school at Christmas 1914 and with his education still incomplete, but declared emphatically that he felt his place to be in the army and he wished to join up. His father, also deeply stirred by the critical condition of the war, complied with his wishes, and in February 1915 he followed his brother into the Lincolns. The two young men, who loved each other as only English brothers can, have not only had the pleasure of helping to make the traditions of the old county regiment, but have also been able to work together and fight together, and had looked forward to the day when old England's troubles were over, that they might walk home arm in arm. His loss, it says, will be deeply felt, not only in his home, but in the future life of the city of Lincoln, where those who knew him felt that he was destined to play an honourable and distinguished part. For Neil Newsome was the perfect embodiment of grit, of high courage and capacity. His indomitable characteristics was his patient determination and his unwearying power to win through. Lincoln has indeed lost one of its most promising and most devoted sons. I'm looking at the photograph of Neil wearing spectacles in army uniform. And I wonder a couple of things, really. Well, firstly, the first obvious thought is that the report telling us there what a powerful man he was, and we know that he had a sporting talents, that he was full of grit, it says, and very determined young man. But this is the first industrial war in history, and no matter how determined and full of grit you are, when you get hit by shrapnel shells, it's going to do you terrible damage, and in this case, kill him. And the other thing is, if he was short-sighted and that he had to wear glasses, how on earth did he get accepted by the army? We know just a few months earlier that Kipling's son, Rudyard Kipling's son, had been rejected by the army because he was short-sighted. Kipling, of course, pulled some strings. In the end, his son Jack was commissioned only to be killed on his first day in action. I'm not sure we'll ever know the answer to that question, but it's just a thought that occurred to me as I was reading that article.
He was, apparently, after the battle had moved on, buried close to where he fell, just over there. But in the subsequent fighting and the chaos around here, his grave, like so many others, was lost, which is why he's on the Tynecott Memorial. His commanding officers wrote that he's a great loss to the regiment, both on account of his soldiering qualities and kindly disposition. Both officers and men were very fond of him, and in him we've lost one of our best officers. A fellow officer wrote a more personal tribute. He said he was a long way the best company commander in the battalion, essentially unselfish, thoughtful for his men, the essence of common sense and thoroughness, with a wonderful pride in his company, a pride which his men answered to and never betrayed. Now, attacking Doshi Farm over there, before he was killed, Newsome and another officer called Hill, they captured 50 Germans, passed them back. By the end of the day, only 10 officers and 275 other ranks were fit for duty. The casualty rate for them that day, despite their successes, was 51%. It's nearly the end of September, the second full month of the attack towards Passchendaele, which I can just about see in the distance, only a couple of miles away. That wasn't to be reached for another, 6-7 weeks? 2 months into the campaign, Allied casualties were already 90,000. They'd gained 3.5 miles. They were about halfway to the Passchendaele Ridge. And Lynn MacDonald, in her famous book, she said, "And the nightmare has hardly begun." Neil had a brother called Henry. He survived the war. He also attended Gresham, and he lived until 1968. He'd been mentioned in dispatches for his action that day. It was reported in the London Gazette on the 18th of December 1917 for gallant and distinguished conduct in the field, the action that he was killed in. Before he came out here, he'd served with his regiment in Ireland during the Dublin Rebellion in 1916, and he'd only arrived here in Belgium in February of 1917. I've got a couple of photos here, and in one of them he's with two other officers, and both of those photographs I'll put on my Facebook page, Tales from the Battlefields, and also the podcast page of my personal website. So what I'm going to do now is, of those men that died on the same day, not all of them are missing. 69 of them died that day. 45 of them are still missing, like Neil, remembered on the Tynecott Memorial. But here in Doshi Farm Cemetery, there are 6 men buried here from the 2nd 5th Lincolnshires. And I'm going to wander along the rows that they're buried in. They're not all together. There are two or three that are in the same plot. And I'm going to see whether there's any clues that Neil could be buried here with them. Let's go and have a look, shall we? So within plot 6, there are 3 boys that died that day. Here's plot 6. And in row D, just here, one row down from Jimmy Spears, the footballer, there are 2 in this row, Roberts and Kirk from the Lincolnshires. Now, being a concentration cemetery, as you'd expect, there are lots and lots of soldiers of the Great War known unto God. But occasionally, one or two of them will have a regiment on, because maybe a cap badge or some other insignia was found on the body when it's been exhumed and the battlefields have been cleared after the war. And the first one I come to, and it's right in front of Jimmy Spears, but say in the row in front, a soldier of the Great War, the Lincolnshire Regiment, known unto God. Now, as we know, there are 45 men that died that day out of the 69 that were killed that are missing. So there's a 1 in 45 chance that that is Neil. Because just a couple of paces away, we've got J. John Thomas Roberts, who's died on that day, aged 24, 26 of September 1917. And right next to him is Gilbert, S. Gilbert. Lincolnshire's next to him is H. Smith, same battalion, 26th of September. So we've got 3 soldiers there who died on that day. And there's another one there with a brand new headstone. Someone's been to see this lad, S.D. Kirk. His name's Sidney David Kirk, again, who's died on that day. And someone's been to see him because he's got a little poppy cross in front of him. And there's a personal inscription there, which I'll just about read. How we miss him, none can tell. I suppose that's a thought that can be assigned to every single one of these, whether they're known or not. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 definites there from the Lincolnshires that have died on that day, and one that's unknown, but could, outside chance, it could be Neil in plot 5, and plot 6 rather. And there's a couple of others as well, actually in plot 5, plot 10 and plot 9. Now you would think, wouldn't you, that these plots would be laid out in order, but anyone who's been to a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery will know that's not the case. There is a plan in the visitor's book in all of these cemeteries, or nearly all of them, but it's much more fun to go and actually look for them. You never know what you're going to find when you wander around and look at these headstones. You end up going on all sorts of tangents and finding new stories. There's only me here. The weather couldn't be much different to how it was in the summer and autumn of 1917. The whole of Western Europe has been so dry for weeks and weeks now. We've had some thunderstorms. That's turned the grass green again. There's been a parched straw colour. Life is beginning to come back. Nature is restoring the ground as it did so quickly after the First World War. Here in plot 10, again the other side of Jimmy Spears' grave, there's one other man called Harrison from the Lincolnshires. There we are, Harrison. And amongst him, there's a soldier of the Great War, Lincolnshire Regiments. That's 2 we found that are unknown. Let's go and look in plot 9. Plot 9 is just here. Row A, there we have Carter, Samuel Carter, age 25, of the Lincolnshires. Either side of him are either named soldiers or soldiers from other regiments. So he's definitely not in this section of the cemetery. And one more in plot 9. Almost feel like a detective doing this. It's a Frank Watson. is in plot 5. All the regiments are so mixed up here. Again, another sign. Concentration cemetery where these bodies, so many of them, have been found maybe 2 or 3 years after they've died. There's another one there, a soldier of the Lincolnshires. And at the end of the row is Private Frank Watson, who was just 20. "Thy will be done," it says on his headstone. He died on that day. So there's 3 soldiers here. None of them have a rank on them. Outside chance that one of those could be Neil. We'll never know. Now, some of the other men that died on that day, buried in Tynecott Cemetery, the largest cemetery of them all. And there's also a smaller cemetery called Bridgehouse Cemetery. So we might pop in there later and see whether there's, again, any clues there that Neil does have a final resting place. If he doesn't, then he's perhaps under that new farm complex over there where he was killed by shellfire, leading his men on the 26th of September 1917.
So what I was hoping to find was a grave that didn't just say a soldier of the Lincolnshire Regiment, known unto God, but sometimes when they find a soldier and identify his regiment, they can identify that he was an officer, or even his rank, in this case, captain. We know that there were 2 captains that died that day, Newsome and Hill. And the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, or the Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was at the time, even if they couldn't identify the individual soldier, if they knew it was a captain, if they knew it was an officer, that information would have been inscribed on the headstone. But on this occasion, I failed. I couldn't find one. Either in Doshi Farm Cemetery, close to where they fell, or at Tynecott, just about a mile away. I didn't get to Bridgehouse Cemetery, run out of time. So when I go back next time, I'll go to Bridgehouse, which is a bit strange that they're buried there, because it's a little further back. It's not an obvious cemetery where you would think that boys that had died up at Doshi Farm would be buried, but there's always a reason, isn't there? And next time I go to Ypres, I'll visit Bridgehouse Cemetery near St Julian and see whether I can find a headstone that could be Captain Newsome or Captain Hill. I'll let you know the outcome. But Neil is remembered on a headstone in his home city of Lincoln. There's a cemetery in the city, civilian cemetery called the Eastgate Cemetery. And there's a family plot there. A Latin cross set on a 3-tiered concrete base. Some of the lettering has fallen off with time, but it says, "In proud and loving memory of Clement Neil, second son of Henry and Alice Newsome, who was killed in Flanders, serving in his 21st year. Greater love have no man than this." Neil Newsome is just one of the hundreds of thousands of casualties from both sides, from the Passchendaele conflict, Third Battle of Ypres. But this podcast is all about picking up these untold stories and following them through and seeing if there is an outcome. At the moment, there isn't, but there may well be. But either way, we keep his memory alive by listening to this podcast.
So this is the story of a New Zealander. And he died on the 12th of October 1917, a date which amongst New Zealanders will never ever be forgotten. The British, we talk about the 1st of July 1916 being the worst day in the history of the British Army. Well, this day, although the numbers weren't as great relatively, they were equally as disastrous for the New Zealanders. And for Rifleman 29012, Herbert Harris of the 2nd Battalion, the New Zealand Rifle Brigade, he was 28 years old when he died on that day. I have his service record in front of me, being a New Zealander. The records are all complete. And it tells us that he was wounded in action in June of 1917, 16th of June. He went through the various stages of evacuation. It must have been a relatively minor wound because just less than 2 months later, he was back on duty with his unit. But his service record tells us simply that he was killed in action in the field on the 12th of October 1917. And that day, his battalion attacked close to Doshi Farm Cemetery, where he's now buried. There'd been an attack along this ridge just a few days earlier on the 9th of October, and that was equally as disastrous. And the BEF, their hopes now rested on the last of the five planned hammer blows scheduled for the 12th. Far from calling off the attack or delaying it to allow adequate preparation, Haig and the British generals mistakenly hoped they could achieve what the previous effort had not, the final dislocation and break-in of those strong German defences on these ridges. Now look back towards Ypres, crops are high, but above the crops, the sweet corn crops, can clearly see back towards the area that the New Zealanders would have been forming up in on that autumn day. There were 13 divisions attacked that day. The Anzac Corps at the front, the attack we made in the same two divisions that succeeded around in the Tynecott area on the 4th of October, the New Zealand Division and the 4th Australian Division, led by Major General, the famous Major John Monash. The Australians would take Passchendaele, while the New Zealanders supported them on the left by taking the Bellevue Spur. Because of the lack of time in preparing themselves, and the heavy rain had turned the ground into an absolute quagmire, preparations for this attack were no more satisfactory than the one 3 days earlier. The artillery batteries were not completely in position. It would take hours, sometimes days, to move these guns, even the light guns, into the right position. And those that got forward were set up in the mud. The ammunition remained limited because they couldn't get the ammo up either with the guns. There was no systematic bombardment of the barbed wire or the pillboxes, nor were the gunners able to deliver an effective creeping barrage when zero hour arrived at 5:25 a.m. Although opening with an impressive roar, the artillery barrage became ragged or even petered out, and even worse, many of the shells fired by the Royal Artillery fell amongst the waiting infantry before they'd even gone over the top. After enduring a few minutes of shelling from their own side, the infantry moved off in drizzle that soon turned to driving rain. It's what we think of when we think of the attacks that took place here in October and November 1917, that horrible driving rain. Herbert's battalion was part of the 3rd Rifle Brigade, and they pushed on till they were halted by machine gun fire. On their right, the 2nd Brigade rapidly came up against the barbed wire that sloped across their front that they were attacking. A few determined individuals got through the barrier, but they were quickly killed. Most of the rest were forced to take cover in shell holes. Only on the extreme right was there any progress, with several pillboxes captured. Germans on the spur ahead enfiladed not just the 3rd Brigade to the left, but also Monash's Australians on the right, and it effectively prevented progress on either front. Orders came for another push at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Thankfully, it was cancelled at the last moment. The troops eventually fell back to positions close to their start line for the badly wounded soldiers lying in the mud. The aftermath of the battle was a private hell. Many died before they could be rescued. They sunk and drowned in the mud. The mud that's now covered by crops. Extensive efforts were made to get them out in the next 2 days, assisted by an informal truce that developed because the Germans refrained from firing on stretcher parties. The final toll was absolutely horrendous. There were around 2,700 New Zealand casualties. They included about 950 men who were either dead or mortally wounded. 843 of them are officially listed as dying on the 12th of October, and the rest succumbed to their wounds in field ambulances and hospitals behind the lines in Belgium, France, and even in the UK. Some died many weeks later. Herbert Harris was one of those that died. It's impossible to know exactly when wounded men lying between those lines or out in no man's land may have died. It's the blackest day in the existence of New Zealand. Herbert was 28 years old, it tells us that on his headstone. What it doesn't tell us is that he was a simple farm labourer from New Zealand. And of course, being on the other side of the world, they couldn't be much further away, could they? So his family penned a poem that I found in the newspaper archives. It simply says, Private Herbert Harris, killed in action in France. Well, he's not in France, he's in Belgium. October the 12th, 1917. Reinterned in Doshi Farm Cemetery, northeast of Ypres. And that means that this is a concentration cemetery. His original burial place was close to where he fell. And after the war, he and some of the other lads here that are with him were exhumed and reburied in this cemetery, which was one of the strong points, Doshi Farm, on that ridge in the autumn of 1917. The poem simply says this: We find it hard, so hard to part, nor can from tears refrain, but hope to soothe our aching hearts, whispering, we'll meet again. Inserted by his loving father, mother, and sisters. Now they'll, of course, have all passed on by now. It's very, very doubtful whether they came all the way from Canterbury in New Zealand to see Rifleman Harris. But in front of his headstone now, I'll place that poem. And hopefully I can reunite him physically with his family. I'll take a photograph of Herbert Rifleman H. Harris from Canterbury, New Zealand. With his photo and that poem in front of his headstone here. And I'll put that on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk, and also on my Facebook Tales from the Battlefields page. We will remember Rifleman Harris, won't we?
So there's just two stories from the Passchendaele battlefield. One from North Norfolk in England, the other one from far off Canterbury. Two locations on the other side of the world. Two boys who probably never met. They can't have met, I wouldn't have thought. Thank you once again for tuning in to this podcast. And please do continue to rate and review the podcast wherever you get it from, especially on Apple and Spotify. They seem to be the two main platforms where it's downloaded from. And I think it's appropriate this week that we do sound the last post in memory of Captain Neil Newsome and Private Herbert Harris.